Does it make sense for large oil companies to dive into the solar industry? The trade war between the US and China also makes its toll on polysilicon companies. Is there an end to it? And why is the International Energy Agency always so conservative in their solar estimates? This and more will be discussed today. My name is Martin Hirt, and you are listening to a podcast from Sisla Energy and Ocean Industries. We're very glad to welcome Jenny Chase, Head of Solar Insight at Bloomberg New Energy Finance. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Jenny.
Thank you for inviting me, Martin.
According to your New Energy Outlook that was published last summer, an additional $3.7 trillion are to be invested in the upcoming 25 years in solar energy. And I'm just curious, how do you get to such a number? How do you work at Bloomberg to sort of pinpoint that it's $3.7 trillion?
Are you sure you want to ask an analyst about their methodology? Because this could take some time. So basically, we have a global model about which the bare bones of it is it includes retirements of existing power assets like coal and gas plants. It includes power demand growth and also power demand reduction in the economies where we're expecting power demand reduction, mostly the very developed ones. And it also has a lot of economic inputs. So it looks at what's cheapest in any given year, what countries need to build capacity, and then it builds the two or three cheapest technologies in every year. There's also a small-scale solar model, which is modelling consumer uptake of just solar on roofs, which is a really big part of the solar inputs in the developed world. And altogether, this gives us a capacity outlook. And of course, there are CapEx forecasts in the underlying economics calculation. The CapEx forecasts are based on the experience curve that we've seen for the past 25 years projected out. And then we basically multiply the deployment by the dollars, and we get a 3.7 trillion number. It's actually about 3.4 terawatts of new solar.
Right. I think you did a very good job of describing your methodology and still keeping it short. So thank you for that. You're predicting a large growth. And about a year ago, you said in an interview with Bloomberg Business that you couldn't kill solar now, even if you wanted to. What has happened to the solar industry over the last years that makes it possible to come with such a powerful statement?
Well, basically, solar's got really cheap. The price of solar modules is about 20% of what it was in 2008. And what we're seeing in particularly countries that are sunny and need a lot of power capacity to be added, they're actually running tenders where they get bids to buy power at prices that are at parity or even sometimes lower than their fossil fuel offers. We're also, of course, at rooftop parity. There are many parts of the world where, depending on the exact regulations, you can stick a solar panel on your roof and get a better return on that just from saving energy than you would on an equivalent investment. So essentially, it's so cheap that I think people will carry on doing it somewhere in the world if you removed all the subsidies and even if you put a moderate amount of taxes on it.
You also, as you mentioned, that rooftop solar will dominate in the future. And I'm wondering, how will that affect the grid? Because you're talking about a decentralized power system, if you sort of take it to the extreme. You have the grid, and also you have not least utility companies who find themselves sort of being disrupted from below. Their business models are on what they used to be. How do you reach the conclusion that small-scale solar will dominate?
Well, first of all, you look at the economics, and you can see that the payback periods, if you can use the solar to save your energy, are pretty short. They're sort of 3 to 6 years in many places, and that means that people will want to put solar on their roofs. Now, at the moment, power bills, particularly in Europe, have a very high proportion of variable cost. So we pay most of our power bills on a per kilowatt hour basis. And that's probably going to change because you can't have people simply choosing to cut their electricity bill by 30% and and still relying on the grid when the sun's not shining. It's simply not possible for the utilities to keep the lights on under that situation. So, and what's happening in the US is an incredibly fraught confrontation between utilities and the solar bodies, where the utilities are saying, "Hi, could you please pay us something for keeping the lights on when it's dark?" And the solar bodies are saying, "No, we generate our own solar. We shouldn't be paying for it." And I think some kind of compromise is required.
Is that what's going on in Nevada at the moment?
Exactly. Yeah. So in Nevada, basically the utilities won a round. In December, the solar companies won a round in California as well. So it's an ongoing battle, state by state, and it will probably come here to Europe as well.
Yeah, I saw Bloomberg had an animated GIF of Warren Buffett fighting Elon Musk. That was both disturbing and amusing at the same time. you also mentioned subsidies that we've reached grid parity for some areas. What is your take on the future of solar subsidies going forward? I know in the UK they've slashed subsidies quite a lot. I think the new feed-in tariff was put in sort of to function as of today. I think I read somewhere.
That sounds about right. Yeah. So I think in a lot of places we're looking at changing from subsidies to taxes on solar. Mm. Not necessarily the UK, because the UK it's not very sunny, and it doesn't have the highest power prices in Europe. And to be honest, I'm not entirely sure if solar is that valuable to the UK grid, because peak power demand in the UK is in the winter when it's dark. So that's entirely a political decision in the UK. In places like Italy and France and southern Spain, it's fairly likely that there are still some kind of sweetener. They're not the explicit subsidies they used to be, but they are definitely sweeteners for people with solar. I think in the next 5 years, we're going to see that shift to some kind of way of taxing people who have solar for the use of the grid.
Right. So would you say that the political uncertainty is still a major obstacle for solar going forward?
Not really. Well, political uncertainty is always it's a thing. But fundamentally, the reason all these feed-in tariffs have been cut is because the cost of solar have been coming down. It's in response to excessive build of solar that is far beyond what policymakers originally imagined it would be. So in a way, the subsidies coming down is not entirely a bad thing for solar. I mean, it's very awkward if you're trying to build a business, but
there's a question I was actually planning to ask you, but I was taken aback by your brilliant methodological run through that. Because I've noticed it's become more or less known that the International Energy Agency quite often underestimate the growth of solar, most recently at the World Energy Outlook.
Always.
Yeah. Always. What is it that they underestimate or do not understand in your view?
So first of all, I think they're a fundamentally conservative institution which finds it, I think their model is good. I've actually worked with on one of their committees collecting data for their solar modelling, and I don't think I admire the IEA's modelling of energies extremely. I think the problem is that they aren't good at modelling a disruption. Right. They're very good at modelling the status quo and small shifts in it. But what we're seeing is a disruption, and what you probably need is a new model, which is what we've built. They also, being based in France, they tend to be talking to people who aren't really on the sharp end of the disruption.
Careful so you don't insult the French.
Oh, why not?
When I was preparing for this talk, I went through some of your last tweets. It's always a good source of information to find out what people actually mean about things. And the one thing that caught my attention was that You commented on an article questioning whether BP, the oil company, would have been better off had it not pulled out of solar industry in 2011. And you quite emphatically, using caps lock and everything, just answered no. I was curious, what makes you so so sure that that is the correct answer?
Well, you see, I remember it, and they just weren't very good at solar. Or they weren't particularly, they were not very good at solar manufacturing, which is a commodity manufacturing process with very thin margins. You need to have, now BP has some brilliant scientists and engineers who were working on solar research and solar strategy and really understood the stuff. But what they didn't have was a giant factory out in China where they're just trying to grind every fraction of a cent out of the manufacturing process and tweak every, you know, get the wafers a micron thinner, get the silver paste slightly better spread. And that's what you need to bring down the cost to be a good solar manufacturer.
Because one of the reasons I found it interesting, in Norway at the moment, Statoil, the Norwegian oil company, has recently invested in the first floating offshore wind farm outside of Scotland. And they're building up a new renewable division, and they are currently looking at the solar industry, trying to figure out, is this something for us? And if it is, what do we want to do? Where in the sort of value chain is there a room for us? So I was looking at if you would give a piece of advice to a struggling Norwegian oil company that are trying to get in or considering going into solar without any previous experience, is it a good idea at all?
It doesn't have to be a bad idea. I mean, I wouldn't go into manufacturing because solar manufacturing is viciously competitive. And I think that on average, the solar companies I've written about in a 10-year career have had a shorter lifespan than my pets. So it's not manufacturing. On the other hand, some of the expertise, like a low cost of capital, the ability to own assets for 25 years, the ability to negotiate with governments and other stakeholders to get a power purchase agreement, might fit with oil company expertise. So they might want to go into project development or project ownership.
If we leave the oil and gas majors as we're running to a close here, the Norwegian solar industry, we have a couple of international companies in sort of different places of the value chain. Yesterday, REC announced that they had to close down one of their factories in the US, at least for a period of time, and they blamed both lower prices for polysilicon, but also an ongoing trade conflict between the US and China. Could you briefly sort of explain what the US and China are actually arguing about, and what is your take on that situation?
Okay, so first of all, the global price of polysilicon just hit a record low. It's about $13.1 per kilogram on the spot market, which is unbelievably low. I genuinely, 5 years ago, I would not have thought it would hit that level in my lifetime. And part of that is simply that manufacturers of polysilicon in China, in the US and elsewhere have simply managed to get cost out of the polysilicon manufacturing process. And actually, some of them using a similar process to the one REC pioneered, the fluidized bed reactor process, which is it's a wonderful thing. It should work. It's so intuitive. But so part of REC's problem is not just the trade war. It's also just the fact that there is a global oversupply of polysilicon right now. However, the trade war is not helping. What happened a couple of years ago is that the US put trade import tariffs, heavy import tariffs of around 30% on imports of modules from China. And the idea of that was to protect their own domestic industry, and in particular a company called SolarWorld, which is actually German, but manufactures quite a lot in the US. And China retaliated. China historically imports quite a lot of polysilicon from the US. There are some very major US players like Hemlock and Wacker, as well as REC. And China essentially retaliated by saying, we're going to put import tariffs on your polysilicon. And so far, neither of them have backed down. Although there are industry bodies trying to negotiate some kind of settlement, and not have these two countries' manufacturing industries slugging it out. It hasn't worked yet. And to be honest, there's not a lot on the horizon.
No good news for REC in the forthcoming period of time.
What there is a lot of companies based in China setting up factories outside China, so in Vietnam, Thailand, India, in order to get cheaper silicon by dodging the tariffs on US silicon, and then dodge the US module tariffs going back in.
The reason why you are here in Norway, Jenny, is that you're addressing the Norwegian Renewable Energy Partners. I think the English title is, in Norwegian it's called INTPO, so I haven't memorized the English version, sadly enough. You're addressing speaking at Solar Day tomorrow. Do you have any thoughts on the Norwegian solar industry, different niches one could prosper in, or what Norway's role potentially could be going forward?
So the Norwegian solar industry is not very big, as you might expect. Norway is not very sunny. It doesn't install a lot. But it does have some quite innovative companies. And Norway's role has always been to develop the technologies and develop the financing mechanisms that are rolled out elsewhere. So the reason I'm here is to find out more about those companies and what they're up to at the moment.
Just before we finish off, there's a question I wanted to ask you. More on the role of Bloomberg New Energy Finance than the solar industry itself. As I've been working with renewable energy over the last few years, I've noticed that the BNEF is very much a voice that's listened to when you release new reports and outlooks. Do you reflect on the fact that you're also sort of shaping the narrative of renewable energy?
That's why I come to work every day.
Yeah.
Yes. What we set out to do 10 years ago was first of all just to provide accurate data so that it was possible for investors to make investments in renewable energy and feel like they had the information to do it. That was our original setup. Now we're also trying to shape the narrative based on accuracy. And to some extent, this is a disruption. I think you need someone who's a little bit more sensitive to disruption rather than the status quo. And yeah, we're just really focused on this.
Good. As you are the expert out of us, is there anything more you'd like to add before we call it a close?
Photovoltaics in particular installed about 56 gigawatts in total last year. That was a record. This year it will be about 66 gigawatts, which will be another record. And then 2017 is going to be a really exciting year because there's a whole bunch of projects in the US and India that are coming online, and that's going to be a 70 gigawatt plus year. It would be really hard to stop solar now if you wanted to.
Okay, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, Jenny, and good luck with your presentation tomorrow.
Thank you.
Okay,
have a good evening, Martin.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.